Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Kira Gumbs, the Chief Legal Officer of Broadridge Financial Solutions, where he oversees the legal, compliance, and physical security teams. Prior to joining Broadridge, Kira served as Deputy General Counsel and Deputy Corporate Secretary of Uber. Before Uber, he was partner for nearly a decade at Covington & Burling. And he also served with the SEC for 6 years, where immediately prior to joining private practice in 2005, he served as counsel to the SEC Commissioner, Roel Campos. In this podcast, we talk about the Holder Report and corporate governance reforms at Uber, the state of corporate governance in Silicon Valley, particularly on the divide between private and public companies. We also address his current focus with Broadridge and the state of proxy voting and proxy contests, including incoming changes with the universal proxy rules for director elections. In addition, we talk about boardroom diversity, the SEC's enforcement agenda, where we dive into the recent EY enforcement action, and the role of boards with the increasing polarization of politics and corporations. If you like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Kier, it is so good to have you in the Boardroom Governance podcast. I've heard so many great things about you from many people, including prior guests. So it's a pleasure and an honor to have you join us. And thank you very much for taking the time.
The pleasure is literally all mine. I've heard so many great things about you and about the podcast. I've listened to a few of the podcasts, so it's a real privilege to be with you this morning.
Well, great. I typically start with the origin story of my guests. And let's start with you and where you're born, where you grew up, and then we'll go from there all the way to your current role at Broadridge.
Sure. So first of all, I chuckle when you say an origin story as a comic book nerd growing up that has special meaning and suggests I'm a hero, which I assure you I am not. But so I'm originally from California. I grew up in the Bay Area. I went to high school in Oakland. And I mentioned that because I had a really unusual path to where I am currently. So in high school, I ran track and I did well enough my senior year that I had the opportunity to get a track scholarship to go to Ohio State. And when I got to Ohio State at the time, I thought I was like Olympic material. And that was, I realized very, very early on, I was not, because many of my colleagues were in fact Olympians. They went and got gold medals. And so instead of me choosing to pursue track as a career, I decided really not after very long there that I needed to choose a different career. And I chose to go practice law. And so I went from Ohio State to the University of Pennsylvania for law school. And when I graduated from Penn, which was in 1999, if you think back then, it was a really heady time. We were in the middle of the dot-com boom. And yes, most of my colleagues had these ideas, these fantasies, dare I say, of going to these startup companies and making millions of dollars, going to law firms with these lofty salaries. And I made the choice, which at the time didn't feel like the right one, of instead of going to a law firm or to one of these startups, I decided to go to the SEC. So I went to the SEC right out of law school. And you talk about being better lucky than good, because not long after I was there, the dot-com bubble burst. And I was very, very grateful to be at the SEC in that point in time. I worked on tons of IPOs. I worked on a variety of governance issues. But the thing I was really lucky to do while I was at the SEC was work on shareholder proposals. And I was lucky to do that because it was really my introduction to corporate governance. I was part of this shareholder proposal task force that basically every single year, starting from December to March, a small group of people that were gluttons for punishment would get together and review all of the no action requests that were submitted to the SEC. And I did that for, I was there for 6 years total, probably four of those years. I was on the shareholder proposal task force, running it for a couple of those years. And following then that time frame, I had the opportunity to work for an SEC commissioner for a year. And then I went to private practice at Covington & Burling. I was at Covington for about 13 years. didn't think I was going to leave. But during that last year at Covington, one of the things I was fortunate enough to do was work on an investigation of Uber Technologies, which I'll come back to later.
Yeah.
And I did a good enough job that following that time, I had the opportunity to go to Uber as Associate General Counsel for Corporate, where I led their IPO. I built their governance program, the ESG program, which we'll talk about hopefully, and was promoted to Deputy General Counsel. And then at the end of my tenure in Uber, one of my former Covington clients, Broadridge Financial Solutions, reached out because the general counsel was retiring. And even though I really loved what I was doing at Uber, I loved the people, I loved the work I was doing, it was a really great opportunity to come back to the East Coast and focus more on governance and security issues, which are generally my bread and butter. And that's how I ended up where I am today as Chief Legal Officer of Broadridge Financial Solutions.
All right. Well, there's a lot to unpack and a lot of the things that you've done. Let's start with your key role at Uber. Obviously, there was a big governance scandal around 2017 with the founder, and it was all over the press, and it was probably the leading unicorn at the time. And your firm or former firm made a very well-known report, the Holder Report, in which you played a part. Why don't you tell us about the process of doing that, bringing an outside firm to do a special investigation, and what did it entail? I think that's a very important case study for governance, particularly for Silicon Valley companies at a time that it really made a difference in the company.
Sure. First of all, let me start with the headline. The headline is that governance directly and unequivocally impacts value. That's the headline. And for me, at least, Uber is the quintessential example of that. So to really understand it, you got to go back in time. So I want you to think back about what things looked like in the beginning of 2017. And particularly when you think about the unicorns in existence, of which Uber was the biggest, to your point. At that point in time, Uber was king of the world. They were the largest and most valuable private company. They were rapidly expanding around the world. They had already radically changed the way that people get around, right? If you think about pre-Uber days, you would call a taxi, you'd wait 45 minutes, maybe they showed up. If they didn't show up, you called them again and you were hopeful that someone showed up. When you got in the taxi cab, it wasn't always the best experience. I can tell you firsthand the number of times where I had taxis that wouldn't pick me up. That's a whole separate conversation. But the point is, it wasn't a great experience. And Uber had radically changed that. You could press a button, you get a ride within a minute or 2 minutes. And so it was viewed at the time as a real success story for Silicon Valley, for unicorns, for startups, for technology more broadly. Things changed very, very quickly in early 2017, because at that point in time, there was a travel ban that Trump had put into place. And Uber, unfortunately, made some bad decisions during the context of that travel ban, one of which I'll talk about in a moment. But I don't want to start with the travel ban. I want to focus on the blog from an ex-Uber engineer by the name of Susan Fowler. And people forget this all the time. But where these things started was Susan Fowler posted a blog that basically was about her very unusual and unfortunate experiences at Uber as an engineer. And what she talked about in that blog was the really just appalling way that she was treated as a woman in the engineering department at Uber. There are a number of stories that come out of that, but all of them suggested that it was a culture in need of change, right? So that was point one. You have the Susan Fowler blog. People were starting to focus, what's the culture at this company, Uber? And then you have the travel ban, where Trump basically implemented an order that basically said that people from certain countries weren't going to be allowed to come back into the United States because of concerns around terrorism and other things, and immigration more broadly. And so at that point in time, there was a protest that was taking place at airports in New York. And the way that Uber's app worked is that whenever it's a really supply and demand based application, so that if there's really high demand, lots of riders are looking for drivers to take them places, and there isn't enough supply from a driver perspective, then you have this thing called surge pricing, where the rates go up so that it will attract theoretically more drivers to the platform to satisfy that high demand. And at the time of the travel ban, because of this protest that was taking place at the airports, demand was way, way higher than supply. And so Uber, I think actually trying to do the right thing, turned off the surge pricing so that you wouldn't have this additional fee that people had to pay in order to get cars. Unfortunately, the way that it was done and the way that it was communicated was misinterpreted by the public. And it led between that and the Susan Fowler blog to this Delete Uber campaign, where basically, literally overnight, and there's data that shows this, there were hundreds of thousands of people that decided they weren't going to use the Uber app anymore. They were literally deleting the app, right? And from a value perspective, going to where I started, governance impacts value. Well, overnight, this company that, again, was the darling of Silicon Valley, the most valuable unicorn in the world, lost literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars overnight because of these decisions. One, the cultural issues that were reflected by the Susan Fowler blog, and two, this travel ban response by senior management. And it set the company into this spiral where all of a sudden, all of these people were coming out of the woodwork talking about the really corrosive culture that existed at Uber at that point in time. And so we were outside counsel to Uber. And I can tell you, I was doing corporate work for them. Some of my colleagues were doing governance and other compliance, litigation, and regulatory work for them. And they reached out to us to basically say, we need you to come in and do an internal investigation. Do we have a cultural problem? Are the issues that Susan Fowler complained about in her blog, are they real issues? Are there things that we need to worry about? For us as a board of directors, what do we need to be doing? And so my colleagues, Tammy Albran and Eric Holder, put together a team, and they went through and they investigated literally thousands and thousands of complaints that were lodged by people, employees at Uber. And at the end of that process, they looped me in to help them do the governance-related assessment for Uber as we were formulating recommendations for the board of directors about what they should do about these cultural issues that had been reported. And we came out with a number of recommendations. It's public. I would really encourage people to take a look at the recommendations, all circled around what was the culture at Uber at the time, and did the culture need to be fixed? Similarly, we looked at the governance. What was the corporate governance practices at Uber? Did they need to be fixed? And there are a number of recommendations that came out of that. All of those recommendations by this point have been implemented, but it was a real, from my vantage point, an eye-opening experience about the way that culture and governance can directly impact value. And as you'll see over time, if Uber had not addressed those cultural issues, if they had not addressed the governance issues that we identified in the report, my perspective is that Uber would not be in existence today. They were on a pathway where employees didn't want to work there, consumers didn't want to use their products, regulators didn't want them in their cities, and so they had to address these governance and cultural issues in order to survive and thrive.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously is a great story and lessons for boards, and I will add the Holder report, the recommendations on the show notes so that people can read them. One of the things that I think is really interesting as well is it's kind of emblematic of a culture in Silicon Valley at a time which was grow at all costs, right? And that at all cost really was something that caught up to Uber. And I think Uber was particularly aggressive in its practices. And you mentioned these two cases, but there have been many other cases where they've kind of caught up with the law and different excesses. And one thing that is interesting as well is founders versus, maybe investors or others, empowered founders in an environment in Silicon Valley where a lot of the venture capital gave into founder-friendly terms because it's so much competitive pressure to get in the deals. And you know, that balance seems to be at this stage. And so Travis at Uber is a case. At more extreme and egregious, and of course, fraud with Theranos. I mean, that is a different case. But Adam Neumann at WeWork, you know, they're all kind of paired in this like overempowered founders with different degrees of, you know, what they were doing. And it seems to me now, and maybe I want to get your reaction, that because of this market, you know, down cycle, and maybe terms may change. We've seen enough. I mean, it's not clear that they will have this power. And that's where governance, I keep saying, it's in this environment where governance really matters. When everything is up and to the right, you know, people are happy. Investors are happy. You know, consumers are happy because they get cheap rides, whatever. But now it leads to paths that you can't go back. So what are your thoughts on that, on maybe empowered founders and maybe terms in which startups and maybe this is more Silicon Valley-centric and unicorn-centric?
It's such a great observation. It really is. And I do think that for Uber and WeWork, and there are other examples as well. Theranos is certainly one of them. It's a real case study, I think, in the ways that, going back to my headline, governance impacts value. The real question in my mind is, has Silicon Valley learned its lesson? Have they learned? Have the VCs learned? I mean, here's the truth of it. For every Theranos, for every Uber, for every WeWork, there's a Facebook. And let's be very candid here. Yep. Facebook is still very successful. If you were an original investor in Facebook, you have done very, very well for yourself. And let's be very clear here. They have not changed some of the governance practices that are generally disfavored among institutional investors. They have not embraced all of the best practices around corporate governance, and yet Facebook is still thriving. And so from that vantage point, even though I'd like to say that Silicon Valley has learned its lesson from WeWork, Theranos, Uber, and the many, many, many other examples that are out there, I am not sure that that's the case. The one thing that is clear is that there's certainly more awareness now of how governance can impact value. And there's certainly more awareness of certainly among the VC crowd. But look, for every VC crowd that's out there, their ultimate goal is to be able to take that company and package and sell it to public investors. And it's very clear that among public investors, the traditional institutional investor crowd, they're going to have expectations around governance. They're going to have expectations around single share, one class voting. They're going to have expectations around annual elections of directors and majority voting. And to the extent that you're not addressing those expectations, certainly in the IPO process, but I actually think you need to think about it well before then it's going to be much more challenging for you. And so look, frankly, when we took Uber public, we decided, in light of some of the things that we were going to do, that we needed to embrace in a very full-throated way best practices around corporate governance. And it wasn't just because we wanted to feel good about ourselves. It's because when we talked with the banks, when we talked with insurers, our D&O insurers and otherwise, they said, we're not comfortable taking a company like this public unless we see very market improvements around your corporate governance practices. And so certainly the influence is there. And I do think that Silicon Valley has progressed so that there's much more awareness around these issues. But it remains to be seen whether future VCs, whether VC-backed companies are adopting best practices out of the gate. And I'd say the lion's share are not. The lion's share are still following that traditional path. But I do think awareness has been raised. And I think from a you know, thinking about firms like Theranos, right, or WeWork, I think VCs are certainly more skeptical of kind of throwing everything behind the founder with no questions asked. I do think that day has largely passed. It's the exception to the rule where that's the case now. But I don't think they fully pivoted to embracing best practices around governance, corporate governance yet. But we're certainly inching towards that.
So here is a perhaps provocative take, and maybe this is coming from the Silicon Valley side, right? Which you know as much or more than I, of course. So if you think about the last 30 years of public corporate governance, it's gone into empowering shareholders and giving them more rights, right? So if you think of Sarbanes-Oxley, if you think of Dodd-Frank, we've given shareholders say on pay, proxy access, majority voting, and all these terms that in general are better for shareholders. And the investor class, and talking about the large institutional investors, the BlackRocks, Fidelity, State Streets of the world, really mandate, don't mandate, but have a strong influence on corporate governance today, in public corporate governance. Now, in Silicon Valley, in private companies, people said, well, wait a minute, I'm the one making the decision. So you take a founder and said, well, we don't want all these decisions to be made by or influenced by the large shareholders. We want to have it. And in fact, if we go public, we're going to go public with kind of, remember when Snapchat went public, the first company to go public with non-voting shares, right? And I remember reading a story where they interviewed the State Street investor, one of the portfolio managers, and asking him about the deal, because all these large institutional investors came and invested in private markets and invested with these terms, right? You have, you know, Evan Spiegel and the other partner having a very strong form of dual class shares or triple class shares in that case. And he said, look, I think that if you would have gone public with one share, one vote, Facebook would have snapped them up really quickly. And they wouldn't, Evan Spiegel would not have had the time or possibility of putting his vision up there. Which is interesting because it's the same State Street that represents a very strong form of pushback against this. Now, the Council of Institutional Investors kind of said, look, okay, we understand this and we're going to give a 7-year sunset provision, right? So you can do a dual class, but we'll give you 7 years in a market to prove this, right? So it's interesting. It's a give and take. And to me, and I don't know about you here, but I feel like this is all about who makes the decisions. And everyone in this ecosystem thinks, you know, they have a lot of power and decision-making and they know better, right? So it's a push and pull between the founders, between the investors, and now there's more stakeholders, right? That's a whole different discussion now going into the stakeholder mode. But it's interesting because this is why I think people in Silicon Valley are like, well, first of all, maybe let's not go public. And that's, you know, like the private company versus public company. Like, we don't want to deal with this environment because then you add activist investors, you can add, you know, short and pressures of dealing on a quarterly basis. So it's a very complicated kind of scenario where it's not clear to me that the best corporate governance, public investor-driven governance is the best overall. But it's interesting to think about it from the perspective of the founder. And look, the reality for VCs is they're going to put money where they think they're going to have a return. And if they think that, you know, we're going to give all the shares to this founder, but it's going to be a Facebook scenario, I'm sure that 10 of the 10 VCs will say, I'll sign the check.
I think that's right. I think the challenge is that it's a little bit of the law of numbers, law of averages, which is to say, yes, it is possible that one of those VC-backed firms with the founder, with really bad governance, is going to get 100x returns. Like, that is absolutely possible with bad governance right. In place. But it's also the case that on average, if you don't have good governance, that you're not going to get those returns. Because the truth is, you know, with a lot of these founders that are out there and just young companies in general, they need help, they need oversight, they need management. And that's where governance comes in. That's where the investors can really help those companies as they build their businesses, as they grow, as they hire employees, as they build enterprise value to eventually be returned to investors. And I do think there's a balance that has to be struck, right? Like, you certainly don't want to go out with a startup company with full public company governance. That doesn't make sense, right? For a lot of reasons, you want to give the founders the opportunity to be able to control the company in the way that they want and need to build the business, to build value, right? But there has to be some transition over time. My own view is that transition should correspond to the growing number of investors that are participating in those companies, so that when you're really small, it's not quite anything goes, but you can do a lot of what you think makes sense. As you become public, and certainly as you become a larger public company, I think some of those less favored governance practices necessarily need to fall away, because you got a broader set of stakeholders, they've invested, the company's operated, yeah. And you've had the opportunity to incubate that business over time. And I really think governance should reflect that.
Yeah, I obviously agree. And there's a lot of nuance in how you evolve from private all the way to public. And so you've gone now to Broadridge, which is at the belly of the beast, right? Like, this is like the core public company at the center of all things governance. Why don't you tell us about the history of Broadridge? I don't think people understand how important the company is, particularly in its role with shareholder communications, proxy voting, director elections. People who do governance, everyone knows Broadridge because it's kind of the company at the middle of all of it, but maybe not everyone else understands. So maybe you can give us a bit of color over Broadridge.
Yeah, sure. And you know, you're totally right. It's almost on the other end of the versus where Uber and some of these startup companies were. So just for folks who are less familiar with respect to Broadridge, let me give you a kind of fireside chat version of what Broadridge is and who we are. If you have an account with, say, a Merrill Lynch or a JP Morgan, Morgan Stanley, pick the bank or broker dealer, and you get account statements, you get trade confirmations, you may have an annual meeting that you're voting where you get a proxy statement, and you'll get an email from them or a communication saying your trade confirmation, your account statement, your proxy statement is available. That communication may say Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, whomever, but in most instances, that communication has been powered by Broadridge. And the way that I'd like to think about us is that we are effectively, we're a fintech, you know, financial services technology company who provides a network utility connecting most banks and brokers with investors and the rest of the financial services world. And so that's the way to think about it. The place where we're probably most known, or at least among the corporate community most known, mm-hmm. is in the context of proxy solicitations. And that's because when you're a company and you're conducting a proxy solicitation, there's basically two groups of shareholders that you need to connect with. One is the registered shareholders. These are the people that show up on your books and records as people that you know hold your shares. And the second bucket of investors are beneficial owners or street name owners. And these are people who own shares through banks and brokers like you or me. And just to give you some numbers there, roughly 70 to 80% of all shares are held beneficially, i.e. are held through banks and brokers. And the remaining portion are held directly on companies' records. And so when you think about proxies, you think about investor communications, in particular, you think about Broadridge and the role that we play. When companies want to get to that 70, 80% of their investors, they're going to typically use our technology to do so. To think about this in terms of, you know, reaching out and connecting with people, we connect companies with their investors who hold their shares through banks and brokers. That's the way to think about it.
Yeah, and obviously there has been a lot of talk about shareholder communications and the meme stock era, right? We've just seen a pandemic where there's been a surge of retail investors, and with Robin Hood, there've been some discussions about T+1, T+2, and discussions on blockchain and whether this is too slow and the financial plumbing is kind of working well. What is Broadridge doing? I mean, you sit at the middle of that, right? And I know, I remember reading years ago a speech that Vice Chancellor Travis Laster gave at CII and saying that one of the solutions for the voting problem that companies had was blockchain, and kind of criticizing, I think, Broadridge as a monopoly. And I thought it was interesting, and I'm sure you have a response to that. But what has happened since then? I mean, that must have been like 3 or 4 years ago, but has blockchain become more prominent within your organization? Do you think this is, you know, maybe more of a fad? What are the thoughts behind this?
Yeah, it's great. And by the way, I was there for that speech. I was in the room when that happened.
Okay.
And so, look, here's the thing about blockchain. First of all, we are big advocates of using whatever technology exists, including blockchain, to do our work more efficiently, saving money for, you know, companies, investors, funds, et cetera. So like clearly we're on board with the concept. But there is a real practical challenge when you think about blockchain. And the way to think about this is, remember, you know, the network that we've created among banks and brokers. And it, like, think of us as almost like the telephone utility. We're connecting each of them with each other, trying to net out transactions to make things more efficient, particularly around communications with investors. each node in that network has its own technology, right? So to use a blockchain analogy, each firm has their own tech stack. They have their own way of communicating. They have their own resources, product development plans, technology development plans. And in order to get blockchain universal, you'd have to move each of those firms from their own technology stack onto one technology stack that they all agree to. And when you take into account, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of financial services firms, not just like three or four big ones, but hundreds of them all doing the same thing, all agreeing on which technology they're going to use, how they're going to deploy it, et cetera. That's a really, really tough thing to sell. And you have to remember our role in that process, which is they are our clients, right? So we can't dictate to anyone
right.
which technology they use. So there are certain things clearly where we're able to move the needle on ourselves, right? So when it comes to things like electronic delivery, we move the world from a place where 100% of communications were paper to one where less than 20% are paper right now, right? Most communications we send are electronic. You think about settlement. The SEC put out a proposal to move to a T+1 settlement cycle. Well, 80% of transactions are already settled within one day because of our technology. So we're certainly on the same page as Stryne and anyone else who's looking at this concept of how do we move things to move embrace technology more fully, including blockchain. But I have yet to hear a solution for how every single financial services firm can be moved simultaneously onto a blockchain technology that they all agree to. And that's the real predicate for all of it. Even if we wanted to do that, there's just that logistical question of how do you get the whole industry to move. I do think over time, and we see this more on capital markets than we do on the governance and proxy side, we certainly see people coming up with applications that make sense using blockchain technology. We have one. The DTC and others do. You see some exchanges moving in that direction. I think over time, you may see more companies and may perhaps the whole industry moving in that direction. But it's not something that we can do overnight. And I certainly don't see that happening in the near term because it's very difficult to get the firms to agree on very much right now as it relates to technology. Each one is doing their own thing. I do think we'll get there over time. I'm not sure that it's necessarily going to be blockchain, but I do see a industry-wide movement to upgrading and innovating and improving technology. I'm just not sure that blockchain is going to be the solution that everyone embraces.
Sure. And as we record this, and for the record, it's 1st of July, there is a big crypto implosion, and as equity implosion as everything else, but there's been about $2 trillion wiped out market. So there is big questions on crypto as a technology and a lot of their applications. And so that's moving, you know, very quickly. Let me ask you a different question on the proxy contests. In this environment as well, with equities trading so low, there could be more activism and maybe also private equity investors buying off companies from public markets and taking them private. You know, what is your role in those proxy contests? Do you see them on the rise? Is that gotten better, worse? What is your thought on this process?
You know, it's really interesting. One of the things that drives our business is we look at events, which in our mind are things like proxy contests. How often are these proxy contests and similar things happening? And, you know, this year has been we're wrapping up the proxy season. So the books aren't closed as yet. But as a general matter, you know, the level of proxy contest activity seems a little bit lower than what I think we would have expected as of, you know, July of 2022. One of the things that we're watching very closely with respect to proxy contests is the new universal proxy rule that's going to go into effect this fall. So just for the folks who aren't familiar, historically, when there's a proxy contest, you have two different proxy ballots. You have one for the company, and then you have another one for the insurgent group. And what typically happens is that the insurgent group will have two or three candidates, and then the company will have a full slate. And if you're an investor, you kind of have to choose which ballot am I going to use? Am I going to take the three people that have been recommended by the insurgents, plus a few other folks from the company's ballot, or am I going to take the whole company's ballot? There's very limited opportunity for investors to mix and match candidates in a proxy contest. And that's something that has really been challenging for institutional investors who may look at a proxy contest and say, I like one candidate from the insurgent slate and nine candidates from the board slate. How do I implement that? And historically, the only way to do that realistically is to go to the meeting and turn in a paper ballot. We can, Broadridge has had these bespoke solutions from time to time that they can offer for investors, but it's something that is largely unsatisfying from the investor community perspective. And so the SEC adopted rules that basically say, and these rules go into effect in August, the rules basically say going forward, if there's a proxy contest, each side has to have a ballot that includes all of the candidates so that an investor can choose mix and match. I want one from the company and nine from the insurgent or vice versa. That's going to be a new rule, goes into effect this August. I bring that up in response to your question because even though things are relatively quiet right now, one of the open questions is, will this new universal proxy rule meaningfully impact the way that insurgents think about proxy contests, i.e., will there be an increase in proxy contests because now the logistics around the proxy contest have been changed dramatically because of this universal ballot rule? And so all of the expectations and predictions that we can make based on historical observations, in my mind, are going to be thrown out the window in August because it'll be a new world. Now, my own view is that the existence of a universal proxy ballot won't dramatically increase the likelihood that insurgents start proxy contests. I don't think it will change it dramatically, but it does change the calculus a little bit because now as an insurgent, you can get all of the company's nominees on your card, and that may change the kind of the leverage that you have as you're negotiating with companies before, during, or in the midst of a proxy contest. And so I think that's a really open question. And as far as your question, the role that we play, we're a neutral player in the process. We don't take sides, and we just want to make sure the one thing we care about is that when the contest happens, that we are getting all of the ballots out to all of the relevant investors, that we tabulate the vote and we get it in and complete our part of the process as quickly as possible without creating any controversy. And let me give you an example. Historically, in some of the larger proxy contests that have taken place, you'll have hundreds of ballots. They're going back, not hundreds, millions of ballots changing hands at the last minute. And typically, our process is done. Even though we handle the vast majority of proxies in a proxy solicitation, our process is typically done within minutes of the meeting. We can finish and certify to the company, here are the results as it relates to the proxy, the part of the process that we handle. Often, when there's a controversy following a proxy contest because there are questions around which ballots are counted or not counted, it's not happening on the beneficial, on our side of the process. It typically happens, going back to the two buckets of investors I was describing earlier, it typically happens on the registered side of a proxy contest, i.e. the people in a company's records, not on the street side. We're pretty proud of that fact, that we usually finish the process pretty quickly, and we can certify that within minutes of a meeting, but it's worth noting. But to answer the whether there's more or less, we are not seeing an increase right now in proxy contests, but the big asterisk is universal proxy isn't in effect yet. We'll see what things look like in December or March after that rules had time to be affected and used.
All right. Well, it's a great point that you bring up, the universal proxy card. And one big area that I wanted to talk to you about is board diversity. So I'm obviously, I live in California, and recently we've had two of the California laws struck down by courts, and it's unclear whether the state of California will appeal, but that's still pending. One focused on gender in 2018, more women on boards, and the other on minority, which was AB 979. And also, there's been a lot of push on board diversity, not only from the states, but from, you know, regulators, from the stock exchanges. NASDAQ has a diversity rule. You know, what do you make out of, number one, the effect of these laws getting struck down? And number two, how have you seen the evolution of board diversity? Certainly in California, we saw a lot of change. This impacted public companies, again, not private companies. And what do you see of the future? Is this something that you think is progressing in a good way?
You know, board diversity is incredibly important. I think it is one of the things that, first of all, diversity in general, I think is incredibly important for any organization of any size. That is certainly true with respect to public companies. The developments in California with respect to the laws that were struck down, I think are pretty interesting. I personally would not read too much into those. And I say that for two reasons. First of all, there's this cliche, a figure of speech I like to use is the idea of spinning in the wind, i.e. doing things that aren't really going to make a difference. In this instance, I think the horse, I'm going to use another cliche, horse is out of the barn. Horses are out of the stable.
Yeah.
Investors, employees, customers, the general public care about the composition of boards of directors from a diversity perspective. People expect to see women and underrepresented minorities on boards of directors, full stop. And whether these laws are on the books or not doesn't change that fact. And in fact, from my vantage point, when we engage with investors, when we talk with our customers, when we talk with our employees, they look at the diversity of our management team and they look at the diversity of our board of directors. And there's a very strong expectation universally that our board of directors is going to reflect the diversity of the country and certainly the diversity of our employee base and the diversity of the communities in which we operate. And so while it's certainly the case that these two California statutes have been struck down, I don't think that they really, that those decisions necessarily will change the path of increasing board diversity. I think that that's a path we've been on for some time. You can look at the number of women on boards of directors, both in the United States and globally, and see that there's been a real increase in the number of women on boards of directors. Same thing with respect to underrepresented minorities, a very marked increase over time. I expect those trends change. By the way, we're not anywhere near done. Mm-hmm. The number and percentage of diverse board members is still breathtakingly low, full stop. In terms of what from a legal regulatory perspective, you know, I think there are a couple other trends worth highlighting. So obviously the California laws have been struck down. You still got the NASDAQ board diversity rule that that is going into effect. And then you've also got the SEC's contemplation of additional rules around disclosure for human capital and board diversity. And my expectation, again, based on conversations with the SEC, conversations with the investor community, and conversations with other members of the corporate community, is that whether the SEC adopt those rules or not, there's going to be a continued focus by companies on diversifying their boards of directors. That continuing effort and trend is only going to accelerate if the SEC adopts rules mandating additional disclosures around boards of directors. And so I don't really see the California decisions impacting that, because again, I think the horse is really out of the barn on the desire by investors, employees, customers, and the broader public to see diverse boards of directors.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I've said so. And also, as you said, the expectation from institutional investors, they're going to start voting out boards that don't implement diversity. Proxy advisors also have rules around this. So I agree that this is already in place. Talking about the SEC, there is a lot of discussion around enforcement practices or regulation, maybe more so than in a long time. The new chair has put a very strong agenda There is a lot of discussion around disclosure of climate changes. There's a new crypto enforcement team. As a former insider or former SEC staff attorney and advisor to a commissioner, how do you see this new administration, this new SEC enforcement agenda? Is this going to be a strong change in terms of how companies operate? And do you think the agenda is the correct one?
Wow, that's a really loaded question there.
It is. I don't want to put you in the spot, but I thought, you know, you could have interesting views on how the SEC has been dealing with some of these issues.
I do. Well, first of all, I have to confess my bias. I am an avowed SEC homer. I think that I think what the SEC does is incredibly important for protecting investors and markets. So let me just start with that. There is no doubt a very pro-enforcement regime at the SEC right now. And if you look at all of the different enforcement matters that they've brought in recent weeks, including yesterday, there was one involving EY that is really like, you should take a look at it. It is very clear that from the chairman on down, they are really focused on ensuring that all actors that they have jurisdiction over.
Are you talking of the EY case?
Yes.
That is, to me, by the way, I just want to say it. It is insane. This is the SEC, $100 million fine because EY was cheating on its ethics exams. The people in charge of enforcing ethics on companies, they are cheating. I mean, it's outrageous, to be honest. I mean, yeah. It's incredible.
It is a lie. It is a lie. And the thing is, just to pause on it for a second,
yeah.
I encourage listeners to take a look at the order. You know, there's a summary, but look at the order. Also look at the dissent from Commissioner Hester Peirce. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting to your point is what was the violation here? And it was like this, as you said, there were people cheating on CPA exams. That was a problem. Very clearly, that's a bad thing. There's definitely precedent for the SEC bringing cases like that against audit firms for failing to police cheating. Unequivocally, that's a bad thing. And again, I'm not trying to cast aspersions about EY itself, but just to acknowledge there's precedent for that. What's really interesting, if you look at the order, is that a lot of what the SEC focused on was the fact that EY didn't come back to the SEC to correct a prior communication that they made to the SEC that suggested that the cheating problem wasn't a problem. And there's issues around the chronology and when they submitted it and did they have a duty to update, et cetera. But at its core, when you look at what the SEC is talking about in the order itself and the way that they describe it, they're not just focusing on the cheating. They're focusing on, from their perspective, the lack of candor by EY with respect to the enforcement staff around that cheating. And that actually really captures the sentiment at the SEC right now. They are holding everyone involved to an incredibly high standard. Now, I'm not going to say whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, but it is a fact. It is a very, very high standard that they are holding people to. And so to your initial question, what does that mean? What do I take away from that? What I take away as a general counsel is that we have to be extraordinarily careful in how we conduct ourselves, incredibly careful in how we communicate with the SEC, how we conduct internal investigations, how we characterize things when we're engaging with the SEC. And it does, you know, there's that, again, another figure of speech. There's a new sheriff in town. There is clearly a new sheriff in town, and they are ready to go after everyone that they think is a wrongdoer. There was another insider trading case yesterday involving a former senior person at a public company. Another example, if you look at the fine in that case, they're very, very serious around enforcement. And so to your question, what does that mean? How do I interpret it? Well, there's always this pendulum that swings when there are changes in administration. And in my mind, this is an example of that pendulum swinging very, very hard and fast towards a pro-enforcement, pro-regulation agenda. And so people have to be wary. People have to be very careful in how they're conducting themselves. And look, that's not a bad, it's not a bad thing for people to be concerned around SEC enforcement. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Insider trading is bad. Fraud is bad. There are people that have lost all of their retirement savings being defrauded. Those are bad things. And I applaud the SEC for going after that. But it does mean that people have to be very, very careful around their compliance programs, because the SEC is there. And like I said, there's a new sheriff in town.
Mm. So, you know, we could be talking for hours on governance. Let me ask you one last question on this before we jump into the rapid fire questions, which is the politicization of corporations. And we've seen an environment in the US and all over the world, by the way, where these political matters are getting at the front of boards, at the front of companies, the gun laws, abortion, and different issues are being really put into decisions of CEOs, and maybe as like never before. How do you recommend or advise boards to deal with these matters? There are delicate matters. There are polarization in society in general. But it seems like these days corporations are expected to take a stance. And so this could be somewhere where general counsels play a very strong role in terms of advising boards. What do you make of this new trend?
Yeah, it is a new trend. The example that I would give you is that Broadridge, like many companies, has over the last couple of years assembled a group of employees focused on when and how we should speak in light of different controversies that may come up. And when you think about groups like that, the quintessential example of where companies have historically said, we are not going to speak, is abortion. And yet, here we find ourselves in 2022, many of us, and I can certainly speak for myself, thinking about how are we going to talk about abortion? Not whether we're going to talk about abortion, but how we're going to talk about it, because our employees, our customers, many of our stakeholders are expecting us to do so. It is, from my vantage point, an incredibly hard challenge for general counsel and other senior executives to manage. You know, when I was at Uber, the George Floyd murder took place while I was there, and we had a lot of conversations internally about how we should speak, when we should speak, and what we should say when we did choose to speak. And one of my big takeaways from that experience is that, particularly for general counsel and corporate secretaries, you have to be thinking about those questions all of the time. You have to have an open dialogue with your executive leadership team and with your board of directors about how you're thinking about those issues. And you don't have the luxury of not speaking most of the time. I think things to your question have changed dramatically, where it used to be the case where people didn't expect employers to talk about those issues. Those days have passed. Employees expect you to say something. And the thing that really struck me at Uber during that that time frame was that employees were talking about these issues on the message boards. They were talking about it on the blogs. And when we didn't speak initially, there was this kind of universal view of, why aren't we talking about it? Why haven't we heard from senior management? What does our board think? What are we doing? How are we responding? And so the stakes have really been raised for people in executive roles and thinking about these partisan issues. And frankly, I really don't think you have the luxury of not speaking in most cases. Now, how you communicate is super important, right? Don't necessarily have to take out the full page ad in the Wall Street Journal. You don't necessarily have to go on Twitter and spout off your views. You don't necessarily have to send out this massive communication. It can be internally focused communications, thinking about town halls and forum like that. But I think it's critically important for companies to accept that we're in a world where there's heightened expectations around communications, and there needs to be this mutual understanding among the leadership team and the board about how you're going to exercise your communication obligations in that environment. It's not an easy question. as I mentioned, abortion is the quintessential challenge that companies have to deal with, but we have to deal with it. You can't put your head in the sand. The expectation is there by, again, employees, stakeholders, customers, and shareholders for you to say something about it. And so you can't really avoid it.
Although there is a counter trend where companies like Coinbase said, look, we can't have all these discussions internally. And we made a decision that we're going to just be mission driven. And if you don't like it, you know, we'll give you a generous payment package and the door is open. Brian Armstrong, the CEO of the company, said that 5% of the employees left. And, you know, he said that was the best decision for that company. Now, maybe it is a stance, right? Maybe that is a position. And others are following. Kraken, another crypto, maybe it's crypto, maybe it's more on that end of things, said the same thing. But we may see other companies take a stand like that because these are polarizing issues. And employees, I mean, this is, I think, something that you would obviously know a lot about in terms of thinking about how employees deal with this, right? And dealing, you know, Silicon Valley has had an issue with employee activism, right, for a long time. And that is something to really think about, not only from the general counsel's perspective, but also from the board's perspective.
Yeah, so look, I gotta be careful in what I say here. Let me just say this, Coinbase. When Brian Armstrong said that, I'll just be very candid. For me, I was like, that means I'll probably never be a Coinbase customer because I care deeply about the companies that with whom I give my money in any way, shape, or form. And I'll give you a contrast with that if I can. First of all, I'm not sure that's a trend so much as there are some companies that choose not to pursue that trend. And they are totally entitled to do so, by the way. But let me share one of my favorite companies in the world to this very day is Procter & Gamble. Mm-hmm. And I love Procter & Gamble. I worked with them for years when I was in private practice. They've heard me say this. I've said this to the management team and to the board 100 times, which is the really, really thoughtful companies can find a way to communicate effectively around these highly politicized issues without alienating everyone in a way that's consistent with their corporate values. And I use Procter & Gamble as the quintessential example of that because I think they have done a tremendous job over decades of when these issues come up, thinking about who they are, what their brand is, who they're communicating to, and communicate it in a way that's empathetic and thoughtful, but also is responsive and timely to address those issues. And so I do think there are examples of companies that do it incredibly well. Procter and Gamble is the example of that. And then there are companies like Coinbase, which, again, it's a free market. People make choices. When they took that position, my choice in a free market was I don't want to do business with them. And so, you know, that's my view on that.
All right. I would love to ask you 1,000 more questions, but I know we are restricted on time. Rapid fire questions. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
There's one that stands out hands down every single time that I get to ask this question. It is the autobiography of Malcolm X. And I mention that because when I was in high school as a freshman, I read it. And that was a point in time in my life where, you know, look, I was a good kid, I had good grades, but I was a chronic underachiever, like chronically underachieving. Every teacher, you look at my value, like, he has such aptitude, such opportunity, but he's distracted, ADHD, whatever it is. And I read that book and it really just changed my viewpoint about how I viewed myself and the use of the talents that I had at that point in time. It literally totally took my life and put me in a different direction. And so that is the book. It was a fantastic book. And so that's my one.
Okay. No, that's great. Who are your mentors and what did you learn from them?
There are two that stand out. First one is this guy, Marty Dunn, who was a legend of the securities bar. Unfortunately, he passed a few years ago. And the reason that Marty stands out to me is that he taught me two things. First is, even if you're doing something really important, really serious, you can still have fun. He was the smartest and best securities lawyer I ever worked with, and also the most fun human being. Everybody wanted to be around him. Everybody wanted to learn from him. And so that's lesson one. Second person is David Martin, who is my former mentor and partner at Covington & Burling. He's a former director for the Division of Corporation Finance. David stands out because of his mentorship. When I was at the SEC deciding on going to a law firm, I was looking around. David reached out. And he basically said to me, "Keir, if you come to Covington, I will be your mentor. I will be what's called a Dutch uncle," which I didn't know what that was. It's basically someone who is going to be very, very hard on you privately, but in public will sing your praises. And David single-handedly, I think, helped me build a career at Covington, leading to me becoming partner and leading to me going to Uber and becoming chief legal officer in Broadridge. Those are my two people, Marty Dunn and David Martin.
Wow. I never had heard the expression Dutch uncle. So here you learn a new thing every day. I love it.
You got to look it up. You got to look it up. It's a great phrase. No, it was a great Dutch uncle.
Okay. Are there any quotes you think of often or live your life by?
Ooh, quotes. Actually, yes, I have one right here. So there is a book that I read, and this is also one of my, you know, if you ask me what books, other books are influential for me, there's a book from this called The Trillion Dollar Coach. It's by Eric Schmidt, Jonathan Rosenberg, and Alan Eagle. It's about this guy, Bill Campbell, who is one of the most renowned mentors and coaches in Silicon Valley. And there's a couple of things that from it, it's a great book about leadership and management. Anyway, here's the quote. It's a quote from the book about Bill. And here's what it is. It says, "Leadership is not about you. It's about service to something bigger, the company, the team." Bill believed that good leaders grow over time, and that leadership accrues to them from their teams. He thought that people who were curious and wanted to learn things were best suited for this. And there's no room in this formula for smart alecks and their hubris. And I love that quote because to me, being a leader is not about you. It's 100% about your team. It's not about the authority that you are imposing on everyone. It's the authority that they're giving to you to lead them. And I think that's such an important way to think about leading, governance and management and things of that nature.
Love it. I had heard about the book. I never read it. But of course, Bill Campbell is considered the coach of Silicon Valley. And I can't believe I haven't read it yet. I remember seeing him many times when we were running at Stanford different director college programs, and he was always very impressive. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
This is really embarrassing. Zombie apocalypse, everything. I love zombie apocalypse movies. I love the books. My daughter and I talk about preparing for the zombie apocalypse. I think the reason that I love them is not so much about the zombies. I love the story of human perseverance. I love it. And I love hearing about the way that people think about surviving in these really, really crazy atmospheres, including when there's a zombie apocalypse. So that's my one.
I have to say it's a very good one and one of my favorite responses, zombie apocalypse. Finally, which living person do you most admire?
You know, I gotta say, I really struggle with that one. There are a lot of people that I think have done great things. You know, it's a tie, I would say, at least in my mind. One is very unusual. It's not someone who I necessarily agree with in terms of every political view, but it's one who I love the way that they use social media. That's AOC.
Okay.
If you read some of her responses on Twitter, again, I don't necessarily agree with every view. She's hilarious. She's so good with the quick response. And then the second one, when I think about people using their power for influence and to do good, as I look at Bill Gates, the way that Bill Gates has built his business and then transformed into focusing on being charitable and improving the world. There's certainly issues with him, but I really admire the way that he's focused his effort on doing things that are good for the world. And so those are probably the two that come to mind.
Keir, thank you so much for your time and wisdom and corporate governance views. I mean, obviously, very informed by many, many different layers, the SEC, law firm from corporate side. And so obviously, this is great public company, private company side. It has been an honor to have you in the podcast. And hopefully one day when you come to the Bay Area and in return, we'll get to meet in person.
That would be fantastic. Evan, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.